The topic today is cognitive bias, and this is kind of a continuation of the clubhouse I did in March on objectivity. And we even, in that session, began talking about cognitive bias. So, as I say, it'll be a continuation and possibly a little repetition, but I'll try to be brief. I want to cover three topics. One is the nature of cognitive bias, talk a little bit about it and the way in which I've dealt with it. And secondly, the various techniques for countering cognitive biases. And then finally, how the whole package fits within the objectivist concept of objectivity and of rationality. So let me begin. Cognitive bias has been an active field of research since at least the 1970s. I've been interested in for a lot of most of that time, and actually gave a talk about it in a course I did, a summer seminar course back in 08 called Counterfeit Reason. It has now become very widely known, popular issue. There are a lot of non-academic sources for information about it. If you go online and search for cognitive bias, you can find lists or charts that list, up to 200 different biases. Most of these are a little, off the chest, so to speak. One of them, there's a, on one list I saw, there's something called the humor effect. Which, a lot of these things have no research background or support. And they vary largely in how they define them, how they classify them. I can talk a little bit about the classification problems in the question if anyone's interested. And even at the theoretical level, there are a lot of empirical claims that have been challenged. There are rival theories and interpretations of the data. So research is ongoing. But there's little doubt that those biases exist. Confirmation bias, the granddaddy of them all, for example, is a well-known example. It was described as far back as Francis Bacon in 1620. He actually gave a wonderful statement that pretty much covers the waterfront in terms of what we now know. A lot of it's been confirmed. Confirmation bias, I would define as the tendency to look for and take account of evidence supporting a conclusion while ignoring or downplaying or failing to seek evidence against it. And that's now a familiar term. I'm just defining what I hope is a pretty common understanding among this audience. Psychologists have provided strong evidence for other less obvious biases. In my logic textbook, college textbook on logic, The Art of Reasoning, for the fifth edition, my co-author and I, Debbie Hutchins, added a new chapter on cognitive bias. It was the first textbook in its class to provide a full chapter, and the first to include exercises for trying to get to them. Those I can talk again in the question period if anyone's interested about the difficulty of making up exercises, and I can explain a little bit now about why, or give you an idea. Debbie and I define cognitive biases as systematic psychological tendencies to make errors in seeking and interpreting information. So they're psychological tendencies, and they involve errors. As tendencies that produce errors, they're somewhat like fallacies, but fallacies are logical errors that we can address by giving examples and asking students to recognize cases. For example, ad hominem. Why should Congress consult the Joint Chiefs of Staff about military funding? They're military men, so obviously they will want to get as much money as they can. Well, we're attributing to the military people a vested interest that distorts their view from the beginning. I'm not saying that's never a consideration, but my point now is simply that you can state the logical form of that fallacy. Someone X says something P, plus you say X has some negative trait, a vested interest or some sexual misbehavior in his past, whatever it might be. Therefore, you conclude P is false, which is wrong. And once you see the pattern, you can give some further examples, teach students how to identify it. It's all conscious. But cognitive biases as psychological tendencies often operate below the surface of conscious attention. And that makes them harder to be self-aware of and harder to create exercises, which, as I mentioned, we did in The Art of Reasoning. In that chapter, I should mention, we covered eight cognitive biases that I as isolated as the best researched and defended ones. So we can discuss others besides cognitive confirmation bias in the question period. Others include things like hindsight bias, what's called availability, and so forth. I don't know if we can post the a list of those. I sent those to Lawrence to put up in the chat column if possible. So that's a general notion of nature of cognitive biases in a nutshell. In the rest of my this presentation, to open the discussion, I want to focus on two issues, which I mentioned. One, the next one is countering bias, techniques for doing that, and then the relationship of all this to the ethics of the virtue of rationality. So, countering bias. Some people, researchers in the field, regard the human mind as just hardwired to be vulnerable to these biases. And some psychologists believe that. Daniel Kahneman, who's one of the founders and major researchers in the field, he believes that. But we are not hardwired to be victims of them. They can be countered. consider the comparison with fallacies again. To get at what we have to do in order to counter them, fallacies are logical errors that can be avoided by understanding why the conclusion is not supported by the premises. Begging the question, for example, another fallacy is involves trying to support a proposition with an argument in which that very proposition is a premise. So the argument is circular. It goes nowhere. That's a logical error. Though fallacies do seem plausible, that's why people commit them. They don't need special psychological techniques to avoid them. You can teach them in a logic class in college or wherever. But biases do require special psychological techniques precisely because they're psychological tendencies that often operate below the surface of conscious awareness. So to avoid them, we have to be more self-aware of the cognitive and motivational factors at work. There's no inherent reason why this can't be done. In a way, you can make an analogy between cognitive biases, which are conceptual level issues, with perceptual illusions like the bent stick in water. We've all seen that, and it's easy. We can't help seeing the stick as bent because of the laws of refraction. And the way our eyes work. But take the stick out. You counter it. It's easy to counter it. Just take the stick out and look, see it straight. Once heard about a, I don't know whether a humorous or malicious teacher who had a teaching this subject and had a stick in a glass of water. And when he pulled it out, it actually was bent. See, he might have been a vicious skeptic or just having fun with the class. Anyway, but perceptual illusions can be countered and in the same way as a lot of physical imperfections. Bad eyesight, we correct with glasses. There are lots of ways of countering what may be a tendency or a factor that's innate and just create, you know, creates a challenge for us, but a challenge that can be met. Among the many issues of or many forms of countering biases that I developed, Debbie and I developed and wrote about in our the chapter in The Art of Reasoning. Thanks for putting that up. One of the most important is to ask yourself about something you believe. What would I take as evidence that I'm wrong? It helps to talk about people who disagree with you because that, you know, they're the most likely ones to provide you with that evidence. But you, even that question alone, when people are seriously asked to take some view that they hold and consider, okay, what might be a good argument against it? It just changes the mindset, and it is, if you're honest about it, it can be effective in countering, especially confirmation bias. Another question, do I want this to be true, what I believe? Do I need it to be true? And if so, why? Because, you know, we can be passionate in the pursuit of knowledge, but the knowledge itself, you know, should not be dictated by our passions or goals or values. And the way, one way I like to put this is, would I rather be right or get it right? Would I rather be right in the sense of winning the argument, getting my opponent to concede, or do I want to get reality right, regardless of what anyone else believes? I think the best counter to this, and this gets us maybe toward the ethical issues, is to anchor your self-esteem not in the truth of or, you know, extent of what you believe, but in your commitment to grasp reality as it is, so that errors are not a threat. They are an opportunity to grasp reality better. One technique that I like comes from a book by Annie Duke called Thinking in Bets. The idea is that how much money would I bet that I'm right in this prediction, this plan, this view about politics or Ukraine or whatever it might be? I'm going to read a short quote from her. Being asked if we were willing to bet money on a belief makes it much more likely that we will examine our information in a less biased way, be more honest with ourselves about how sure we are of our beliefs, and be more open to updating and calibrating our beliefs. The more objective we are, the more accurate our beliefs become. I hope I take a slight digression here. Two objectivist friends of mine, both economists, expert economists, and very successful in their fields, the couple they told me once that sometimes when they're out on a trip driving, often say in unfamiliar country, you know, they're looking at the gas gauge and the wife says, well, we're down to a quarter tank and there's a gas station right there. Let's fill her up. And the husband says, no, it's too soon. Why fill it up with a quarter of tank left? We'll fill it up at the next one. And she says, well, we don't know where the next one's going to be, how far it's going to be, whether our gas is going to last. And the husband, who's a little less risk averse, says, okay, I'll tell you what. I remember, these are economists. I'll post $1,000 bond, that which is yours, if you if we run out of gas. And that solved the issue. It was not an argument. It was just an offer. He was making a bet that they'd find a gas station, and he put his money where his mouth is. Anyway, I've discussed some of these points in a short pamphlet I wrote for the Atlas Society called The 7 Habits of Highly Objective People, which you can find on our website. So let me turn now to the final topic of rationality. In March, as I said, I covered the topic of objectivity. And the main point in that discussion was the idea that objectivity means a commitment to finding the truth in the process of thinking by using rational methods. So objectivity, by that standard, involves both a choice and a skill. That is, the choice to focus on reality, to be reality-oriented and committed to objectivity, and the skill of using the methods of reason to use your mind properly. In March, I focused on the skill side of objectivity. It was I talked at some length about the hierarchy of methods that we employ, from the basic standards of logic, which apply across all fields, to the more detailed and often complex methods and specialized mastery in particular fields of science, in law, in project management, finance, etc. And that one point I think I made, I certainly was a point I should have made, is that if those who glibly deny the possibility of objective knowledge are attacking a highly complex and developed product of reason that has gone on, is part of human learning over many decades and centuries. So do not be casual about that. But today I want to discuss the other aspect of objectivity, the commitment side. The element of choice means that objectivity has a moral dimension. And in fact, it is indeed one core of the virtue of rationality. You know, in objectivism, we tend to think of rationality as the choice to think or not to think, to focus or not to focus, to use our minds objectively or to evade or rely on emotions rather than reason, or rely on mystic revelation or on authority. All these things are things that Ayn Rand discussed in various in her novels and nonfiction in some detail. But even so, stated abstractly like that, it seems like, okay, simple yes or no issue. Am I focused or not? As if the mind had a, you know, an on-off switch like your the lights in your living room. But it's not simple, and cognitive biases are an interesting example of why. Just consider the distinction Rand drew, an objectivist in general draw, between errors of knowledge and errors of morality. Someone believes something you think is false. Do you think they're innocently mistaken, or are they culpably evading facts, relying on authority or whatever it is? That's a moral error. So errors of knowledge are morally speaking innocent, but errors of morality are obviously not innocent morally. They're culpable. So cognitive biases, which category do they fall in? Well, on the one hand, the operation of these biases is not rational. It's not simply a lack of information. It's a misuse of information you have and a distorted search for other relevant information. So the biases are failures of objectivity. So are they moral errors? Well, on the other hand, to the extent that they are tendencies operating below the level of awareness, they're not chosen. So are they maybe really, should we assign them to the category of errors of knowledge? You know, sometimes the answer is very clear. If you spend any time on social media, you see the vehement confirmation bias contestants slugging it out and hardly listening to each other, except to find out, you know, how outraged they could be by someone who doesn't believe what they do. So sometimes the answer is clear, but it's not always. I mean, take an example. Example of the cognitive bias that we discuss in the textbook called availability. Availability is a tendency to estimate the frequency or likelihood of an event on the basis of how quickly instances come to mind. For example, you know, we read, people read reports of child abductions, airplane accidents, train derailments, and that leads them to believe that such events are more typical than they really are. You know, it's, the news tends to feature the bad news, not the good ones, precisely because they're not as common as the good outcomes. But still, people are aware of that. And so how frequent are plane crashes? Well, gee, how dangerous is airline transportation? Well, gee, I'm just reading about an airline accident, so maybe pretty much. Countering this bias requires looking at the base rates of such events. That is, how many airline miles, take the number of fatalities, say, over the number of total airline miles, airline passenger miles, is, I think, the normal statistic. And it's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction, less than the frequency of car accidents among all the miles driven. But taking that into account, countering the bias by looking at base rates, is a fairly sophisticated statistical skill. This is an issue of probabilities, and we're not born knowing these. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence from the cognitive bias research that minutes, and there are a number of other cognitive biases like availability that involve issues not getting the probabilities right. So one conclusion to draw is that countering bias in general does involve skill as well as choice. It requires, but it also requires meta-awareness, the task, the commitment of monitoring one's inner cognitive function. That's a skill that people have to learn, but also they have to choose to use and make it part of their normal cognitive hygiene, so to speak. So there's a lot, I think that is as important as monitoring one's inner emotional functioning, the kind of self-reflection that you would do, say, in a therapist's office to get at why you're feeling out of sorts, why you're feeling conflict over this or that. That's meta-awareness too. And one of the glories of the human mind is that we are capable of it, but it's a capacity that has to be chosen, exercised by choice. So there's a lot more to say on the issue, but let me conclude for now.
Great.
The voluntary element.
Okay, David, are you ready to take questions, or are you...
Let's go ahead with questions.
All right.
Yeah,
great. So I brought my partner in crime, Scott, up here. I don't know, Scott, if you had a question, or of course, Roger, who has an interesting new profile picture, which I want to hear all about. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say this one is a little bit personal to me, just because I'm often accused of being biased because I see one side of the political spectrum as more of a threat than the other. And I think I think that it is possible to still be objective and to come to that conclusion. And in fact, there can be a kind of trying so hard to prove that, you know, you're not being cognitively biased that, you know, some people, especially in the liberty movement, adopt this kind of both sides must always be equally bad. And then in trying to prove that, they just kind of, you can still, even within that, still try to, you know, then make everything fit into that mental box if you're trying to just prove that in defiance of the evidence.
I think that's an excellent point, Scott. And, you know, I'm attacking certain policies and positions that I see with the Atlas Society's social media feed. And of course, I'll get the question, why aren't you attacking DeSantis's policies. And I'm like, well, because I think those are the right policies for the most part. So, okay. David, do you have some thoughts on that?
Yes, I take Scott's point, but I think that's more an issue of content than cognitive bias per se. That people are accusing you of bias, yes, but bias is sometimes used just to mean you have a viewpoint, and that's just different. That's not a psychological phenomenon. That's a cognitive phenomenon. You reach certain conclusions, and for reasons, and you know, it doesn't matter where you are on the range of opinion. What matters is where you are vis-a-vis reality and what your reasons for believing what you do are. And then when we engage in discussion and debate, because these are complicated issues, it's, you know, political, anything involving value judgments, veers on the opinion side, rather than the straightforward fact side, the distinction I was talking about back in January. But, you know, there can be confirmation bias. There's a lot of it in political debate. But just having a political view is not itself a cognitive bias. And I wouldn't even say it's an actual bias of any kind. It's a view. Could be right or wrong, depending on the evidence. Right if it corresponds to reality, wrong if not. So I would just answer people, say, if you want me to be in the middle between what and who defines those two ends? How do they get to decide what the endpoints are? Anyway, I'm moving into polemical mode, and I'll stop there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right, Roger. What happened to the old profile picture?
You know, it will come back, but I went on a walk, and that is a view from a little hike that I take from my house, and I snapped the photo, and I thought, you know what, instead of having some menacing photo, let me share a little bit of beauty with the world, and, you know, it's created a conversation piece, so thanks for noticing.
I like it. Okay.
Cool. I have a question for you, David. And I'm glad you're doing this room, because what I'm concerned with is when I'm communicating with people, obviously I have bias, and I put a lot of thought into my ideas, and it's kind of a two-parter. How do I check my own confirmation bias and make sure that I'm not simply regurgitating, things that back up my own established belief system. For example, and I'm sure a lot of us agree on this, is that I believe that the standard, in which governments should arise is to protect individual rights and property rights, and that's really their only role. And then, so oftentimes, you know, when I'm doing research, I go and I look at what the other side has to say, but I'm always looking for like poking holes in their argument and looking for reinforcement of my own. And so the two-parter is, how do I check my own bias so I can keep not an open mind, but a more critical mind to making sure that I'm open to learning? But also, do you have any techniques that you would advise when you're having a conversation, maybe not a debate, because that seems more competitive, but when you're having a conversation with somebody that doesn't see the world the way that you do, to be able to bring to their awareness the biases that they might have brought into the conversation, just maybe a little food for thought for them to go back and think about?
Thanks, Roger. Great question. And, you know, it lies at the core of the work that we do at the Atlas Society as teachers and activists. And, it, you know, and today, I think with all the polarization, there have actually been quite a few efforts on the part of the Heterodox Academy and many others to design, it's the title of one book, the author escapes me for a minute, but it was How to Have Impossible Conversations, meaning impossible conversations between people who seem like they have impossibly irreconcilable views. Anyway, first of all, one thing I like to do just cognitively is just slow down and find out what the other person actually believes, and get in, you know, beyond the surface by just asking why. Why do you believe that? And asking questions that I would raise against it, not as objections, but just how would you deal with that? And you go deeper and deeper. You know, you can run out of steam because the other person ideally should be doing the same thing with you. But that's a cognitive technique that I recommend. Another one is something I learned teaching philosophy in a classroom when I was teaching the history of philosophy. One thing that I just found was, I mean, my responsibility as a teacher was not to convince people of my philosophy, especially in history classes. Ayn Rand is not quite historical yet by philosophical terms, but to talk about Aristotle and Plato, St. Augustine, John Locke, Immanuel Kant. And in doing that, I realized it was helpful and actually became quite a bit of fun. Let me put myself inside that system of thought and just what's the most plausible way I can put it. I did this with, you know, St. Augustine, one of the great Christian philosophers and a Platonist in attitude. And I just found, you know, I was teaching a class. So my goal really was, I was doing this in order to help them understand as best they could from the inside why someone would believe these things. But I had to get inside the system myself. And I found it was actually kind of fun and interesting to make up the arguments, look at the world the way a thinker did. And I think we can apply that technique in everyday conversations with other people. That's something you tend to do in your own mind before or after the event. But that's kind of an attitude shift that I find helpful, might be useful.
Thank you very much.
All right. I want to also just reiterate, if you would like to ask Professor Kelly a question on this topic, on objectivism, on philosophy in general, or current events, please just raise your hand and we will bring you up onto the stage. And also, if you're enjoying the conversation, we are looking to just continuing to grow this room for the Atlas Society Club. So please take a moment, tap the share button at the bottom of your screen, share it on Clubhouse or any other social media platforms. We'd really appreciate it. So, Lawrence, you might need to unmute yourself. I'm not seeing your mute button.
He had some technical difficulties. He may need to leave and come back.
All right. Well, I think we have Professor Richard Salzman, who is a professor of economics at Duke. He is also on the faculty of the Atlas Society as one of our senior scholars. So, Richard, thanks for joining us.
Unmute.
This is fascinating, David. I have a question about, I'm intrigued by your classification of the fallacies as logical and kind of in the conscious awareness, or more likely to be, whereas the biases are psychological and perhaps in our subconscious. Do you think there's any connection between someone being more prone to biases, cognitive biases, also being prone to fallacious thinking? In other words, the overall package is they're just sloppy all around. Or is it possible, imagine a combination where you don't really see someone resorting to fallacies. They might have actually be a logician. But if they have low self-esteem, they might engage in confirmation bias. You know, they just don't want to be embarrassed. And so is there anything like that, any anything you have found in the literature and your studies that, that suggest they go hand in hand or not necessarily?
That's a great question. In researching for this new chapter in the book, I spent a fair amount of time in trying to organize material, seeing whether I could line up the cognitive biases that I wanted to cover with the fallacies that were covered in a different chapter. And there were links, but it was not a perfect correlation. So I didn't make much of that. But however, just take confirmation bias. Confirmation bias leads us to fallacies such as hasty generalization. We see a few incidents and they kind of, you know, fit a narrative we already have. So we generalize, you know, that's the case. You know, all businessmen are selfish and probably corrupt or corrupt if they could be. And so, you read a story that someone with that kind of confirmation bias and not very self-aware could say, read a story about, you know, a Ken Lay or any of the other actually corrupt business people and say, well, okay, that just confirms it. That's hasty generalization. It's an inductive fallacy that involves drawing a generalization from too few or inadequate particular cases. It also, confirmation bias also can fuel what we call false dichotomy. You say, well, it's either, you know, either I'm right or, you know, the only other view, only other possibility is communism, right? To put it from our standpoint. Well, that's a false alternative. There are other many other views, even if those are the two extremes, that many other views are possible. So, but someone who is looking to mainly to confirm his view, will be much more prone to engage in what we can identify when expressed verbally as committing a fallacy. And so there's definitely a link. And I mean, and this at somewhat fine line, you know, here, there are, because a lot of fallacies are committed because people are thoughtless about what they're doing. They're just a little easier to identify and put into language and show the logical structure in kind of a diagram form, just to make it so obvious that's fallacious reasoning. Cognitive biases are a little harder to establish.
Thank you, Dave.
All right, Lawrence. And again, I did see some questions in the chat. I can get to those, but I want to encourage you to go ahead, raise your hand, and come on up. So, Lawrence, yep.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
I think it's working. Mm-hmm. I think perfect. Thank you for doing this, David. My question for you is, I spent my thesis paper in college sort of studying Twitter and how that related to how people used it and everything. And one thing that I think, as you mentioned, you know, there's a lot of biases that we can be seen online that people fall into on social media in particular. And I'm curious if you, when looking at this stuff, do you think that social media platforms are just are making it far easier to embrace your biases, or people have always found ways to sort of find their in-groups and confirmation biases, which is sort of the biggest one you always see on social media? Do you think the platform inherently makes it easier to fall into that, or it's just a nature that we have always been doing?
That's an interesting question. It's really a sociological question in a way, and I don't have a lot of evidence. I mean, but I think these biases, you know, when psychologists write about these biases or any other features of human cognition, they're not time stamped. I mean, these are things that are part of the way reason functions, and reason has been, you know, one of our attributes for millennia, many millennia. And so I'm sure confirmation bias happened in the era of hunter-gatherers. It certainly happened in history. I mean, I mentioned Francis Bacon before, writing about confirmation bias. He gave one of the most amazing statements. It's in Elizabethan type language, but I'd love it if it's a little too long to read here, but out loud to you. But it's just, it is so perceptive. And he was, you know, he knew nothing about social media, and printing was fairly recent in his day. So I'm sure that the kinds of things that we're talking about, the kind of biases that we're studying now and identifying now, used to be just as common in town meetings and backyard gossip and so on and so forth. It just, what social media has done is to make all of us have to listen to the idiots on the gossipers and the town meeting people and the loudest voices. And so it's just, I don't think it makes it worse. It just makes it, very repetitive, very tiring. That's why I don't spend much time there. But I doubt that what we're seeing on social media is new qualitatively. It seems like a difference in quantity, the quantity of voices that are engaged and who can reach us across, you know, continents and whatever.
Thank you.
Thank you. Liberty.
Oh, thanks so much, Jen. If we could just step back, I had a question for David or any of the panel that may would like to answer it. I'm curious as to cognitive bias when it comes to phrenology, like basis on appearance of someone, like say someone has the MC1R gene mutation. Does that instantly give a bias to you when you see a redhead, for example, or, you know, the things they say about blondes or something, for example, does that instantly bring something to your head? And do you make decisions based on that? Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Liberty. I'm sorry.
I was just saying it was a great question. You know, how appearance, people's appearance, how does that play into cognitive bias?
Well, it plays into it because one category or one particular cognitive biases it turns on stereotypes. Now, stereotypes are things that we use all the time. There's nothing wrong, per se, with stereotypes. It's just because what a stereotype means across the board is that you have a conception of what things of a kind normally look like, how they normally function, etc. You get on Clubhouse with me and you have a stereotype of some kind, I hope you do, that I'm not going to spout Marxism. That's one of the reasons you're here. You acted on that stereotype. But there are also, you know, stereotypes that result from what in logic we would call hasty generalization. I know some redheaded people who have hot tempers. Or I know some Irish people that happen to have red hair and they have an Irish, you know, way, you know, kind of, they're more outspoken, say. And so I form a generalization. Redheads are temperamental. Blondes are such and such. That's just a stereotype, and you can The bad ones are based on hasty generalization. The ones involving, particularly the ones involving racial or ethnic stereotypes. But there is one cognitive bias that, in particular, that turns on stereotypes, and that is called representativeness. That is the bias, the tendency to estimate that a probability that a thing or event belongs to a class, primarily by the similarity of the thing to the stereotype of the class. So, for example, if I didn't see your appearance, this is sort of the opposite of stereotyping people. Instead of attributing traits to a stereotype, you're noticing the traits of someone and therefore assuming that they belong to a certain class based on your stereotype of that class. That sounds a little complicated. Let me give you an example. There's say a college student is is politically somewhat liberal. She speaks very good French. She loves dance and other arts forms. Okay, that's kind of closer to the stereotype of a humanities major than it is to, say, an accounting major. So you make a best guess that she's probably, you know, a liberal arts humanities major. Well, but this is another base rate issue. The fact is that there are many more students in accounting than there are in the humanities or in the, you know, the comparative language humanities. And, you know, so, and they're, Within those majors, there are many, many, many different differences. So you're jumping to a conclusion there on the basis of a stereotype. And but it's kind of the reverse of what I think you're talking about. If you see someone who has, and you're actually seeing the person and they look a certain way, you make inferences about what they believe, what race or what personality they have. Representativeness goes in the opposite direction. You see that someone with the trait and you assume, okay, they must belong to this class, this, because they fit the stereotype. I'm sorry, it's laid out much more clearly in The Art of Reasoning.
Well, I mean, just as far as speaking, like it was mentioned earlier, by Jennifer, for example, about Roger's profile picture today. Well, if someone was not familiar with Roger, for example, he has this beautiful picture from one of his walks. But his usual profile picture would instantly give you a different idea of who Roger is based on his normal profile picture. And then who Roger is otherwise is yet even another thing. So
yeah.
It's not just a redhead thing or a blonde thing. You know, we're in this app pretty much sight unseen unless you've met someone personally. So yeah. Looking at a picture, you decide something based on what you're seeing. So that was
now that's fun. A great example. I wish I thought of it myself, Liberty. Looking at Roger's picture, you know, just looking at it, if I'd never seen his previous photo, I'd say, well, this is probably a kind of a real nature lover, maybe photographer, probably an environmentalist, Birkenstock type guy. And because this picture is the kind of thing I might expect from that. Now, all that may be true of Roger, sorry, I didn't mean to say, but I think you could infer a lot of things about you from the picture that probably aren't true, but just because the picture is fits a certain stereotype or resembles a stereotype of a certain kind of person who would post that picture. Yeah, great example, Liberty. Thank you.
Environmentalist Roger says that we need to embrace nuclear.
Richard, did you want to chime in?
I just wanted to ask quickly what, David, you mentioned, and I think it's true, in recent years, maybe the there was an increasing attention and classification of biases. Do you think this is a good thing from the standpoint of they're really trying to remind people to think better? Or as I think I'm noticing, it's for purposes of showing skepticism. It's for purposes of saying to people, everyone's biased and in these dozens of ways, and to hell with knowledge. So you know what I'm saying? On the one hand, it might be a good trend. On the other hand, I'm wondering whether it's just a version of skepticism.
Again, great question. I think it's both. I mean, these biases have been used by skeptics or implicit skeptics. You know, lots of people in psychology say, well, you know, we don't perceive reality directly. It's filtered all through the mind. They're not maybe philosophical skeptics, but they treated all these things as problems for objectivity. And they are problems but they need to be defined. What kind of problems are they for objectivity? So I think, you know, this is fodder for a skeptic's case on the one hand, but on the other hand, the more aware people are of them, the more thoughtful they can be. And I think, you know, it's always when some branch of science gets popularized, you have people running off in all directions and speculating and, you know, making up harebrained concepts and theories. So that's a danger. But still, the awareness of it, and there's some very good non-technical sites that I have found I don't want to take time to look up my bookmarks now, but
I'm not sure how much, you know, we have seven minutes on the clock, but I'm just thrilled to see a few others join the stage. So David, on how much more time you have, would love to get to Christopher.
That's me, unless there's someone else called Christopher. I'm not quite sure.
It's you.
I wanted to ask David a question regarding stereotypes and whether, well, I think he probably is familiar with this term, heuristics. I remember reading an article in New Scientist magazine about 10 years ago in the UK. And they were just, I think it was in that, yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. And how stereotypes and heuristics, are they the same thing, or what's the relationship there?
Some cognitive biases involve heuristics, that is, rules of thumb in thinking that are rules of thumb because they normally work, but not always. And the bias is involved counting on them so much and applying them outside their proper scope of application. So I mentioned, and in fact, one section of our book is, of our chapter is called Heuristic Biases. I mentioned one of them is the representativeness that I was talking about with Liberty. Another is availability, which I was mentioning before. And heuristics are, on the one hand, more general than cognitive biases because of the lots of heuristics we use in a lot of fields, rules of thumb, so to speak, that applies to almost every field and skill, body of knowledge. And they don't always lead us into biases or errors. But on the other hand, I'm sorry if you hear a siren in the background. I'm in Washington, D.C. I don't think it's the president going by. You would be, it would be a long, long wail. On the other hand, in the field of cognitive bias, heuristic biases are only one category. confirmation bias is something different, and some of the cognitive dissonance, another one we talked about, that's not really an issue of a heuristic. Yeah, the concepts are related, but not the same.
I've just brought it up on Wikipedia, David, and I'm just reading what the word heuristic supposedly means, according to whoever's contributed to Wikipedia. It's so, saying that, yeah, it's kind of like an approximation. And I remember Ayn Rand saying that there's nothing worse than an approximation. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I think she was talking about certain kinds of approximations, especially in morality or compromising on principles. But we have to approximate. We don't have time. You know, we're driving a car, we use a heuristic about how fast we're going and how fast is safe to go. And, you know, if I ask you, if you're driving a car and I ask you, well, exactly how fast are you going? Well, you're going to give me an answer that is within the range. So it's approximately right, but won't be, you know, what your speedometer would tell you if you were looking at it directly. So I think Rand's concern was much narrower and specific.
All right, okay. JP.
Thank you. My question is also for David. The way that I have coped with confirmation or cognitive bias is that it was extremely hard emotionally for me to experience cognitive dissonance. And the way I learned to cope it was to expose myself, even as not, through exposure, as a psychologist would say that is what you do. Would you agree that as a practical philosopher's standpoint, this would be a good practice?
I think we'd have to talk a little more for me to give you a good answer. One of the things that there are different forms of cognitive dissonance, but the core one has to do with trying to eliminate dissonance between what you think of yourself and what you have done by denying one or the other or modifying one or the other. And I think the answer is just has to be make an effort to step back and say, well, which thing is true? Do I really have this trait that I thought I had? Did I really do something that violated that trait or commitment? Either answer may be the case. And whichever thing you decide, you know, it's going to lead to different practices. But so that might include exposing yourself more to it in the way people often suggest dealing with phobias. Deal with the thing you're afraid of. You know, just get immune to it. But I think it depends on the particular issue and form of cognitive bias that you're dealing with. I'm sorry, dissonance that you're forming. So let me just leave it there for now.
Right. And I think I took the advice by Ayn Rand on philosophy, who needs it. I think the introduction is written by Leonard Peikoff. I'm not remember if that's correct. You can correct me on that. But he says that, right? Mm-hmm. So this rabbit hole suggested rabbit hole of studying the Greeks and then Aristotle and then objectivism and then go back to everything else. So it's the journey then becomes way easier.
In a sense, yes.
Okay, David, we kept you over time, and if you could just give us a few more minutes, Mr. Sabatini's been so patient and thoughtful in the comment section. So, Mr. Sabatini. Or Mr. Rembrandt, sorry.
Thank you. I appreciate you let me come up on the stage and speak. So my question is, I've done a lot of reading in this space. So this is a really exciting space for me to listen to David speak. And I made an effort to even probably buy his book, Seven Habits of Highly Objective People, if I'm giving the title verbatim. I think I missed it. Not exactly saying it the proper way, but.
That's right, and please enjoy.
Yeah, so my question is, I'm not sure if you're familiar, which I might think you are, with the work of Robert Sternberg's work on triaxial theory and his work on intelligence. But Robert's work that he has, he talks about triaxial theory, and one of the elements is practical intelligence. And within practical intelligence, it talks about a person's, you know, ability to essentially adapt to different things around them, thoughts, abilities. And he has taken that and written another book about highly successful people, in which he believes they have the component of practical intelligence as a way of constructing ideas and thoughts. Now, individuals who might have bad heuristics or cognitive biases, and in which Daniel Kahneman would say probably most people are system one thinkers. They're generally using these heuristics, using fast heuristics all day. It's a way that we use to go throughout our day without having to be mentally fatigued on having, you know, to use slow thinking thoughts, which are thoughts that are usually done to do math equations and so on and so forth. So an individual who's engaging in too much fast thinking heuristics have the ability to be prone to more biased types of thoughts. And so as an individual moves forward in trying to objectively construct ideas and be objective in conversations, it is, you know, highly important for them to try to then change from using slow heuristics, change from using fast heuristics to using slow ones. So it's a construction of how a person, as you said, meta-analysis, so to speak. So my question is, with that said, how much of a person's ability to be objective by using practical intelligence aspect contributes to not using bad heuristics and not using cognitive bias as a way of becoming successful in life? Hopefully that was a transparent question there. Thank you.
I think it was transparent. It's just, there are a lot of things you mentioned and to look at. So you talked about Sternberg and you talked about Kahneman. The in Sternberg, I'm somewhat familiar with this theory of different types of intelligence. I haven't studied it or looked at it in a long time, so I'm not up to speed on it. It's one of many efforts over the years to try to take different intellectual skills and abilities and ask, are there different kinds of intelligence, not just a single intelligence measured by IQ tests? And I think most thinkers who are in the field would say, yes, probably. What they are is, it's classifying them is a difficult task, just as classifying personality traits by the Myers-Briggs tests is, you know, it's better than nothing, but it's only one way of looking at personality. Well, similarly, the view of different intelligence is only one way to look at how the mind works. You know, it's getting at a very true point that the human mind is an amazingly complex thing. And as an epistemologist, you know, I'm just functioning at the high level of intelligence with concept, you know, studying perception and concept formation. But I will say that when you mentioned practical intelligence, I have done a little thinking and actually gave a talk on the capacity of judgment, which is, I think, getting at what practical intelligence means. It's a kind of judgment that a business executive has who just makes good decisions. That's why they make the big bucks, because their decisions turn out right more often than not. And that's because they are integrating a lot of factors, not always consciously. So let me shift to Kahneman. You were talking about, you know, thinking fast and slow. That's actually the title of his recent work on cognitive psychology. By thinking, and he's presenting a theory that is I don't know if there's an accepted name for the theory, but it's that the mind consists of two basic operations. One is more or less automatic responses to stimuli coming in, not reflexes per se, but cognitive responses that operate very fast because they don't require us to think through or engage in logic or analysis. And we live a lot of lives on that, basis, and use heuristics that they may be shortcuts in one sense, but they are fast routes to get where we're going. As opposed to the slow thinking in Kahneman's view is the deliberate, conscious, logical thinking through of an issue. I think I'm not sure about that dual theory of how the mind or how cognition works, but it is clear that we rely on our subconscious a great deal on what we've learned and automated. We're not in the, you know, the completely naive, you know, blank slate situation of a child. Everything we've learned, the ability to speak, ability to think, it is all developed and automated. And that's great. That's one of our, you know, great capacities. But I'm kind of thinking out loud here, trying to connect what you're saying or asking to, you know, elements of objectivism. So I think I better leave it there. And let Jennifer
wrap us up. Well, thank you. Thanks, Professor Kelly, David, for giving us this extra time for this really thoughtful and engaging room. Thank you, Mr. Rembrandt and JP and Liberty and Professor Salzman, everybody who engaged with the conversation. I just pinned the link to the events section of our website. I also highly recommend that when you go on the website, you sign up for updates so you'll get notices of our Clubhouse chats. We have at least two a week with our faculty here at the Atlas Society, and we'd love to have you join us. Next week, we have a clubhouse with Professor Jason Hill, second part of his series on Ukraine. And then we also have Professor Richard Salzman on capitalism, the optimal habitat for humanity. So I hope to see you guys there. And thanks again for this wonderful, enlightening room.
Thanks, everyone.